I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Kaleopa'a Veres, spokesperson for the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement. The organization's first Native Hawaiian convention to be held in the continental United States is happening in June in Las Vegas. Kaleopa'a, thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, mahalo. Aloha, Heather. Thank you guys so much for having us.
So what exactly is the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement?
Yes, so the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, we're a member-based nonprofit in Hawaii with a mission to enhance the cultural, economic, political, and community development of Native Hawaiians and Hawaii. And we've been around for the past 20 years, and every year we put on our Native Hawaiian Convention, and we're excited to bring it to Vegas for the first time next month.
Yeah, why did you decide to bring it to Vegas?
Yes, so we're excited to bring our Western Regional Native Hawaiian Convention to Vegas because it has the third highest Native Hawaiian population in the country. And so 50% of the Native Hawaiian population actually live on the continent. They're living not in Hawaii, but over there. And so this is a great opportunity for us to reach out to our ohana that have since moved away. And so we're really excited to be at the Westgate Las Vegas Resort and Casino from June 19th to the 22nd. It's going to be 4 days of fun. We're going to have cultural workshops on hula, genealogy, Hawaiian language. And then we're also going to have some serious discussions around cultural perpetuation, housing and tourism. And then we'll also have, you know, our Papa Makeke, which is our marketplace. And there you can find all Hawaii-based vendors. It's a great opportunity for those to pick up authentic gifts from Hawaii. And it's also open to the public.
Who's your main target audience? Is it Hawaiians living in Las Vegas, or is it people who travel to Las Vegas, or is it those like me who live here but are not Hawaiian in any way, shape, or form?
I would say it's everyone. You know, anybody who embraces Hawaii is who we want to go and just outreach to. You know, when I lived on the continent for about 6 years. I lived in Oregon, and I was always looking for opportunities like these. And so it's just a great opportunity for us to gather as a community and also network. You know, we're going to be going over hula workshops, and then also those serious conversations that we need to have, because those are all issues that our community faces. So the successes, the struggles, we want to reach out to those in Vegas.
Cool. Okay. What are some of the workshops all about?
Yes, you can check out all of the workshops as well as panel discussions. It's online at hawaiiancouncil.org. There you can find the breakdowns of every workshop, as well as our nighttime shows that we'll have as well.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the nighttime shows because, you know, it's Vegas, so you got to take it up a notch, right? I'm sure Native Hawaiian entertainment is amazing on its own, but when you bring it to Las Vegas, I'm expecting something awesome. So let us know what's going on for the nighttime entertainment.
Yes, so we're having for one night only our Mahu Magic, and that's going to be featuring Sasha Colby. She's the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race for season 15. We're very excited to have her as well as other Native Hawaiian and Polynesian drag performers. And so this will be produced, designed, and performed all by Polynesian drag cast of there right in Vegas, and it's going to be on Tuesday, June 20th. And then we also have an award-winning artist with an amazing voice, Josh Totofi. He will be live in Vegas, and that will feature also some hula dancers, and that will be on Wednesday, June 21st. So we're very excited to see everyone there.
Yeah, that's amazing. So besides this Western Regional Native Hawaiian Convention, which is happening here in Las Vegas on the mainland, what other Native Hawaiian conventions do you hold throughout the year?
Yes, we're very excited to have the Native Hawaiian Convention next month in Vegas, but then we also will have our local one here on Oahu later this year.
Nice. Okay. And so you mentioned that people can go to hawaiiancouncil.org to get more information. So there's more information there about the Western Regional Native Hawaiian Convention. Can they also register right there on the website?
Yes, you can find all the information there. You can register. You can also do your hotel accommodations. And so, yeah, everything you need to know at hawaiiancouncil.org/convention.
Okay, perfect. And give us again where and when it's actually happening.
Yes, it's happening June 19th to the 22nd at the Westgate Las Vegas Resort and Casino.
Perfect. Okay. So once again, hawaiiancouncil.org/convention is the website to go to with all the information. hawaiiancouncil.org/convention. And that's happening at the Westgate Las Vegas Resort and Casino from June 19th to 22nd. So it's a 4-day convention. There's workshops during the day. There's entertainment at night. There's marketplace. And I can't pronounce the marketplace properly, but it will be there. And it will be amazing with all kinds of Hawaiian things that you can buy. And I mean, I can't even say the name of the state properly. You've said it perfectly multiple times, and I still just say Hawaii. But
we're looking forward to seeing everyone there.
Yeah, and people can probably learn how to pronounce it properly once they're there, right?
Yes, we're going to have Hawaiian language workshops, so that's something to check out as well.
That's fantastic. Okay, sounds like a lot of fun. So once again, hawaiiancouncil.org/convention, and it's happening at the Westgate June 19th to 22nd. And Kaleopa'a, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know all about it. And I hope a lot of people turn out to take part because, as you mentioned, Vegas is very Hawaii friendly. In fact, I've heard that it's called the Ninth Island. So it's a perfect place to have it and looking forward to it.
Yes, mahalo, Heather, and we thank you guys for your time.
In 1945, the original care package inspired people around the world. Today, we're reaching 170 million people in over 110 countries. Because when history repeats itself, so does care. Join at care.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and I'm speaking with Dr. Aditi Malik, Chief Medical Officer for the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and CMS wants to remind families that Medicaid and CHIP, which stands for the Children's Health Insurance Program, help support kids by providing access to essential behavioral health services. Dr. Malik, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
So could you tell us more about exactly what Medicaid and CHIP are?
Sure. Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, offer free or low-cost health coverage for eligible children, teens, and adults. In addition to May being Mental Health Awareness Month, May 7th is National Children's Mental Health Awareness Day. So I'm here to tell you about not just these wonderful coverage options, but in particular what they mean for children and families. So each state has their own Medicaid and CHIP program, which provides health coverage for children up to age 19 and families with low and moderate incomes. And folks can go to insurekidsnow.gov, that's insure with an I, and click on Find Coverage for Your Family to learn more about enrollment information.
Okay, perfect. Now, what types of mental health services are covered under Medicaid and CHIP?
Great question. So in addition to routine healthcare visits and emergency services, Medicaid and CHIP also include coverage for behavioral health services. Behavioral health meaning mental health, as well as substance use or addiction treatment services for children, teens, and people during and after pregnancy. These are services to prevent, diagnose, and treat a broad range of disorders. And that can include in-person counseling, teletherapy, as I said, substance use treatment, and services at a pediatrician's office or local community providers, as well as through the school system.
Okay. Why is it so important for children and teens to have access to behavioral health and mental health services?
We are seeing youth mental health problems at an all-time high. They've increased significantly over the past decade, regardless of racial group, ethnic group, geography, and are now at really quite alarming rates. As many as 1 in 5 U.S. children between the ages of 12 and 17 have experienced depression. And in 2021, as many as 10% of students attempted suicide. So this is a real problem that the young people of our country are facing. And many of these disorders start in childhood or in adolescence, and if not addressed, can impact how kids learn, build relationships with others, and develop emotionally. And the good news is early detection of mental health and substance use disorders can have lifetime positive effects if treated and diagnosed early.
Okay. Now, how do those stats compare to historical stats? For example, when we were kids, I mean, 10%, that sounds really high. Has it gotten higher or is it holding about the same?
Significantly higher, really, really significantly higher. So, for example, nearly 1 in 3 U.S. teen girls seriously considered attempting suicide in 2021. That's up nearly 60% from a decade ago. And it was lower when we were children. I don't want to assume how old you are, but it's gone up 60% in the last decade. And a decade ago was higher than it was a decade before that. So these are really increases over time, but a really significant jump coinciding with the pandemic.
Okay, so besides the pandemic, what other factors have contributed to that growth?
Yeah, it's such a good question. There's no one single thing, but in the era of the pandemic, things like school closures, loss of communities and social networks, the loneliness that ensued for a number of children, on top of additional stressors like violence in schools, bullying, online social media overuse, challenges in particular with gender identification and discrimination, are all contributing factors to this surge in mental health issues that we've seen in young people. Wow. And that we are seeing in young people. And I will say there's a particular unmet need for access for mental health care, in particular for children living in low-income communities, ethnic minority youth, LGBTQIA plus youth, and individuals with disabilities and special needs. So this is really, it's an issue that's impacting all children and youth, but there are particular communities or identities of children and young people that are being hit the hardest.
Wow. Okay. So we've been hearing a lot recently about people who have Medicaid now losing coverage because of the pandemic freeze being lifted. So how can families prevent losing Medicaid coverage for themselves or their children or CHIP coverage, or if they don't have it yet and they're just learning about it, to enroll in coverage?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked. So for people that already have Medicaid and CHIP coverage, as we as a country emerge from the pandemic and states return to the normal operations and normal business of checking eligibility for these programs, each state typically checks once a year to see if you or your family members still qualify. So if that is your situation, I want to share 4 things that you can do. One is update your contact information. Make sure that your state has your current mailing address, phone number, email, so they know how to get a hold of you. 2 is check your mail, because when it's time to renew, your state or your health insurer through the state will mail you a letter about your coverage. 3 is to complete your renewal form if you get one. And 4 is if you no longer qualify for Medicaid or CHIP, you may be able to get coverage through the health insurance marketplaces, including healthcare.gov, and get help paying for it. You can even get an estimate of your savings before you enroll. So that's if you already have Medicaid and CHIP coverage. Now, your second question was, if you're not sure or you know that you don't, where else can you go? So I want to share 2 websites. One is the healthcare.gov website that I've already shared, and that's a good landing page to know whether you're eligible or not. The other place to go, particularly for children, is insurekidsnow.gov, insurekidsnow.gov. And you can click on find coverage for your family to find Medicaid and CHIP program information in Nevada, or if you're listening and you live in a different state. You can also call 1-877-KIDS-NOW. That's 1-877-543-7669 to learn the same information about whether you qualify and how to enroll.
Okay. And if families do qualify, but they're not currently covered, do they have to wait for the enrollment period or can they sign up now?
Great question. Families can apply for Medicaid and CHIP coverage at any time of year, including today. There is no special enrollment period like there is for some other kinds of insurance. And you can go to insurekidsnow.gov or 1-877-KIDS-NOW. You can apply online, over the phone, by mail or in person with your state's Medicaid or CHIP agency. And that website will give you information about where you can go in person. The process itself is free and the coverage that it offers is free or low cost for children and adults, for most adults. And most can apply and find out if they qualify on the same day.
Wow, awesome. Okay. So insurekidsnow.gov is the website, I-N-S-U-R-E, kidsnow.gov. If you want to find out if you're eligible for Medicaid or CHIP programs for your child, insurekidsnow.gov, or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW, 1-877-KIDS-NOW. And if you find out you're not eligible for Medicaid coverage or you're losing Medicaid coverage, go to healthcare.gov and see what other insurance coverage options there are for you. That's healthcare.gov. Dr. Malik, I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing with us this important information that I'm sure a lot of parents didn't know about and could definitely make use of. You're a wealth of information, and I really appreciate your time. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. Take care.
To the big-hearted, the bold, the teachers, the growers, the builders, the change makers. We need you. We are the Peace Corps. In more than 60 countries, we go the distance to make a difference. We're volunteers, partners, communities, bringing our experience, joy, and passion to building a better world together. Are you looking for more? Then we are looking for you. Join us at peacecorps.gov.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is American Legion National Commander Jim Triola. May is Mental Health Month, and suicide prevention among veterans is the top priority for the American Legion. Jim, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it very much.
So, on Memorial Day, how should Americans remember the fallen heroes?
I'm glad you asked that question, Heather. More and more, we realize that more Americans are celebrating Memorial Day rather than observing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important that Americans realize where they got their freedom from our service members who have paid the supreme sacrifice. And we want to make sure that Americans know that maybe they should take some time out of their day on Memorial Day to reflect on how they got the freedoms to celebrate to start with. And we also ask them maybe there's a lot of Memorial Day ceremonies around the towns, parades, things like that they should attend, so that they can not only educate themselves, but educate their children that are coming up to become our future leaders. And we want to make sure, you know, visit a veteran cemetery, visit a veteran's home, nursing home, something like that, just so they can reflect. It doesn't take a lot of time out of their days, but just so they can understand how they got their freedom and we're still out there defending that freedom. So,
yeah, absolutely. Now, typically on Memorial Day, we think about veterans who died during active duty rather than died by suicide. But suicide among veterans is a big problem. How prevalent is it?
It's a huge problem, Heather. It's, since 9/11, we've lost 125,000 veterans to suicide. The number is still about 6,000 a year. The daily numbers, you know, we hear them, they're all over the map. We don't know which ones are credible, which ones aren't. But in the American Legion's opinion, you know, we have our initiative called Be the One, and that's to break the stigma of a veteran stepping forward for help. And we want to concentrate on saving one veteran's life at a time. And that seems to be resonating all over the nation between our sports sponsorships and our local Legion posts becoming resource centers for those veterans. So we're teaching our members how to start a conversation and listen to what the veteran is saying and identifying veterans at risk and getting them the help they want within their own communities. Because we feel that in your own community, you probably get the help faster than you would with the VA. Not that I'm discounting the VA, but, you know, we're all suffering with staffing problems all around the United States, both privately and both in the VA system. So the faster we can get that veteran help and get a path to recovery would be the best thing. And we also got to remember the families of those veterans, because when that service member goes out for deployment in a normal state and comes back in an abnormal state, there's no way that that family knows how to deal with that. So we need to help them as well.
Yeah. So with the Be the One campaign, it's targeted more to veterans' loved ones than to the veterans themselves?
No, it's targeted to the veteran themselves. We're just saying that in the event that the family is distraught, you know, it's important that we explain to them. I think from another veteran talking to another veteran, that's a good thing because, you know, we understand each other, but the families don't. So the main purpose here is to save that veteran's life. The family is, I'm not calling it secondary, but the family is as important.
Okay. And then family members can also be the one who reaches out to help that veteran if they notice something is off?
Absolutely. Yes. So we recommend that if you're going to invite that veteran who may be at risk into your Legion Hall or into a community center, that they bring their families with them. Because a lot of times the family member may say something that the veteran won't say, and maybe we can identify the problem through the family. You know, sometimes it's part of the stigma.
Yeah. Now, we talked about the prevalence of suicide among veterans. How have those stats changed since you were active duty? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? Or has it stayed about the same?
You know, I think when I was on active duty, it wasn't as prevalent because I don't think we gave it the attention that it deserved. You know, the name of it was different, shell shock and all that kind of things. And I don't think that we fully understood the enormity of it. And I think that it's only recently, you know, with our post 9/11 veterans that it's come to this point where, you know, it was getting worse. The numbers are coming down, but not at the rate we'd like them like to see them.
Yeah. Okay. Now you talked about veterans at risk. How do loved ones know if a veteran is at risk? And how does a veteran know himself if it's time to reach out for that help that you were talking about?
You know, that's a good question. I the family members are definitely more probably, you know, the veterans have they have pride. You know, a lot of them don't have the courage to step forward. They believe if they step forward, they could lose a family member's children. You know, if they have firearms in a home or if they've got security clearances, things like that. But I think the family member would identify it probably faster because they know what that member was like, whether the veteran may realize it, but not really know what to do. I think the family members can identify it easier. You know, they know what that veteran was like before they left. Or the veteran could be go sitting in a corner somewhere in the house and not saying anything and not wanting to go out and get the help. I don't really know what they would think in their minds. You know, there's so many different reasons why they're in the state that they're in. So,
yeah.
That's why it's so important to have another veteran talk to a veteran because we understand each other. You know, a lot of us have seen the same things and suffer from the same things. Yeah.
So if we see that change in behavior in a loved one, what's the next step to get that veteran talking to another veteran?
What I would do if I was a family member and I identified that, I would call 988, the Veterans Crisis Number, extension 1, and a counselor will speak to the family member and see if they can get that veteran help.
Okay, perfect. And where can people find out more about the American Legion or the Be the One campaign?
We have two websites. One will go into the other. The BeTheOne.org brings you right into Legion.org. And that's a page on Legion.org that explains not only what Be the One is and how to identify a veteran, but it also has stories of veterans in there that have actually had their life saved through the Be the One program. So it's working well and is resonating all throughout the nation.
That's awesome. Okay, so once again, the website to go to, if you want to find out about the American Legion, go to legion.org. But if you're interested in the Be the One campaign, betheone.org, and that will take you also to legion.org ultimately. But betheone.org is the website to go to for this campaign. And if you or a loved one is in crisis, 988 is the National Suicide Prevention Helpline. And if you press 1, that's specifically for veterans. So dial 988 and then choose option 1. And again, the website, betheone.org. And Jim, I want to thank you so much for being here and shedding some light on this issue, especially for Memorial Day. You know, as you mentioned, it's something that people have lost sight of the actual meaning behind it. So it's so crucial to talk about this. And I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me. Take care.
For nearly 2,000 severely injured veterans, everyday life has become filled with barriers. So we build specially adapted homes at Homes for Our Troops. And thanks to our donors and supporters, this life-changing gift of freedom is provided mortgage-free to these veterans. But we need you to join us, too, in completing this important mission. Please visit hfotusa.org and help build homes and rebuild lives.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Jennifer Strauss, National Director of Women and Gender-Related Mental Health in the VHA Office of Mental Health and Suicide Prevention. She's also an Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University and has authored more than 60 journal articles and book chapters. Dr. Strauss, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you.
So it's Mental Health Awareness Month, and I've had guests on to talk about mental health in kids, teens, and veterans, but not specifically women. What are some of the mental health challenges that women veterans commonly face?
Great question. So are women, relative to other groups, both women in the community and male veterans, are women veterans are more likely to experience traumatic events, sexual trauma, intimate partner violence, and that we know are associated with a higher risk of mental health problems. So that's one. There's a higher rate, unfortunately, of those types of experiences. The other thing, when we think about, you know, making sure we can take care of veterans, we're used to thinking about male veterans because the majority of veterans are male. Women veterans are women, and that means there are a host of mental health challenges that are unique to women. Postpartum depression, mood shifts over the menopause transition, things like that, that we think about and we want to make sure that we have all the resources available to take care of our women veterans. A piece of it are these issues that are just unique to being women.
Okay. How does the Today I Am campaign encourage women veterans to take care of their mental health?
Great question. The premise of the campaign is to share stories, real stories of veterans talking about their own mental health challenges and paths to recovery. They are highly relatable and truly inspiring. So for women veterans in particular, I think they can feel isolated sometimes, lonely. I think we've all been there. I think we've all gone through rough times and we know what that feels like. So as sort of a first step towards getting women connected with resources and encouraging, inspiring them to take action, to get help, I would start with this website, this campaign. It's maketheconnection.net. Right off the bat, there are brief videos, beautifully done, of five different veterans talking about their own recovery, and two of those five are women. So I would start there.
Wow, awesome. So you mentioned mental health resources. What are some of the VA mental health resources that are designed specifically for women veterans?
Thank you for that question. We have, you know, truly in the last several decades, VA has really shifted night and day in terms of the breadth and depth of resources for women veterans. We now have a women's mental health champion, every VA medical center. That is a mental health provider with a specific interest and often passion for taking care of women. They have gone through specialized training, and their role at each VA is to partner with others at that facility to expand services for women and to develop new resources that would address women's specific needs. The second thing I'll mention is that the other thing you need is, you know, not just this one point of contact that's focused on women, but we really need to make sure that all of our providers are trained to take care of women. And so we've stood up a strong portfolio, I would say, of foundational but also pretty specialized trainings for our providers to make sure that they know how to take care of women and they're up to date.
Okay, perfect. So what should female veterans do if they feel in the need of behavioral health services? Where should they go?
The easiest maybe way would be to go to the maketheconnection.net website, because there is an option to search by your local community to find out where VA resources are close by. If women is not already enrolled for VA, I'd encourage them to call the Women Veterans Call Center. That information is on the website. There are just ways to connect with, get enrolled, you know, very quickly, and to connect directly with care for women.
Okay. And what about listeners who might have a loved one who's a female veteran and they are not themselves veterans, or if they just want to make a difference in the lives of women veterans in general for Mental Health Month, what should they do?
Probably three things, I would say. One we're doing right now. We just need to talk about this stuff more. as a society, I don't think we talk about mental health yet as openly as we talk about some other things. So, you know, if there's a female veteran in your life or in your community that doesn't seem to be themselves, please reach out and start a conversation. That's the first thing, just open the door. The second thing I think would be to help connect veterans with resources that are available, including this website, maketheconnection.net, because there are just really inspiring and very relatable stories of other veterans and ways to connect with services. And, you know, there are a lot of options for care in our communities, but then also through VA. Please help us get the message out that VA really knows how to take care of women, that we have really kind of specialized care available, including mental health care, for those who would benefit from professional help.
Okay, awesome. So you've mentioned the website, maketheconnection.net. Is that the best place for people to go if they want to find out more about this initiative and find out more about women veterans and mental health?
Yeah, I would start there. I really would. It links to a lot of resources, but it also, like I said, I think if somebody needs a little nudge towards getting help, I think the stories there are just a terrific way to start. And they're brief. They're, you know, 1 to 3 minutes. So it's a relatively low lift, I think, for potentially a very high impact.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, maketheconnection.net is the website to go to. Maketheconnection.net. You can see stories there from various veterans. Some of them are women and male veterans as well, of course. Maketheconnection.net. And then, of course, the suicide prevention line for anyone in crisis is 988. And for veterans, press 1. So 988, press 1. And the website, again, maketheconnection.net. And Dr. Strauss, I want to thank you so much for being here and talking about this. It's really important to include female veterans in our discussions about veterans and mental health. And, you know, sometimes I feel like they get overlooked. So I'm really glad you're here to talk about this and let us know about the resources and what people can do. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I agree with you. And thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Hi, I'm Bob Maxwell, CEO of Voice of the Veteran. In the last year, we have helped secure nearly $4 million in aid and lifetime benefits for veterans. If you're a veteran, call us today at 702-381-2566.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Amy Meyer, Manager of Primate Experimentation Campaigns for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. Amy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is PETA's concern with labs that are funded by taxpayer money?
Well, there's more than 100 million animals in the U.S. being tormented and killed every year in these completely worthless experiments that are not translating to treatments and cures for human diseases. And since there's no such thing as an illegal experiment in the U.S., anything at all can be done to these animals, no matter how ridiculous or cruel it is. So experimenters are severing the spinal cords of monkeys, forcing dogs to inhale toxic chemicals, implanting electrodes in the brains of cats, and terrorizing mice by forcing them into inescapable beakers filled with water. The animal experimenting industry knows that the public will be outraged when they see how their tax dollars are being used to deliberately injure and kill these animals. And so they're fighting tooth and nail to try to prevent PETA from exposing this reality happening.
Okay, so I remember years ago when the main experimentations going on, at least in the cosmetic industry, were things like putting chemicals into rabbits' eyes that was torturing them that way. And then a lot of the beauty industry went cruelty-free after that was exposed. But the experiments that you're describing don't seem to make sense at all. What are they trying to accomplish with these experiments?
Oh, that's a really great question. And you're absolutely right that, you know, there's been a huge turn in, you know, cosmetics and the beauty industry because people have learned about this reality and have started to say, like, no, we're not going to support this. We're going to buy cruelty-free options instead. And so a lot of companies have made that switch after consumers have seen what happened. But there's so many different atrocities being committed by universities and government agencies, and they're going to great lengths to conceal what's happening. So I mean, some of these experiments are so ridiculous, it's hard to even imagine how they got federal funding in the first place. So there was one that PETA exposed recently where an experimenter at Oregon Health and Science University received taxpayer dollars and they were using them to get prairie voles drunk on the equivalent of 15 bottles of wine every day. And then the goal of the research was to see if those drunk voles were more likely to cheat on their partners. So, I mean, this is just, I mean, some of the experiments happening are just absolutely ridiculous like this. But then, you know, there's also experiments happening that are just beyond horrific. So in another experiment that PETA obtained footage from, we saw dogs at Texas A&M University who were being intentionally bred to have muscular dystrophy. And their bodies were just ravaged by this disease so much that they had difficulty walking, eating, swallowing, and even breathing. And so the video footage PETA was able to obtain showed these dogs with stiff legs, struggling to walk. They were very thin dogs who couldn't even eat their watery food rations they were given. And they had difficulty swallowing and saliva would just hang from their mouths. So, I mean, this is, I'm just really scratching the surface of just a couple examples of what we're seeing happening in these universities. But folks can learn more about the kinds of experiments and what they're supposedly trying to study here on our website. And you can see more video footage of these completely pointless experiments being paid for with our taxpayer dollars.
Wow. Now, you said that the laboratories are trying to hide what's going on inside, but we do have access to information acts. So aren't you able to bypass that hesitancy to share and find out what's going on anyhow?
Well, in theory, yes. And like you said, public universities and government agencies are required under the law to be transparent. The open records laws and Freedom of Information Act were passed for this very reason. But these institutions really try to keep the experiments secret. And so they use tactics like charging astronomical fees for their records, or they'll make false claims that the records contain proprietary information and will get them redacted so much you can't even know what's going on. And, you know, and PETA has to fight these every time. And a lot of times we win because the laws are strong. We do have a right to know this information. But it's just really clear that these institutions know that, you know, they will be threatened at their ability to keep receiving taxpayer funding when the taxpayers find out what is happening with their money. And so, you know, we're just saying, you know, if these animal experimenters truly had nothing to hide, they would be releasing this documentation without a fight. But that's just not what happens. They really try to fight us tooth and nail to prevent PETA from showing people what's happening.
Okay. Now, logically, I would want to ask what alternatives to animal testing you'd rather see, but it's kind of hard to imagine alternatives to getting prairie voles drunk. So,
yes, that's a very good point.
But what would you like to see happen instead of these experiments that are obviously very cruel?
Yeah. And so, you know, it's exactly as you mentioned, some of these tests can just straight up stop. We don't need an alternative to know if prairie voles are more likely to cheat on their partners if they're getting, you know, drunk on 15 bottles of wine a day. But other tests do have good alternatives that exist. So, you know, for instance, there's a lot of toxicity experiments that happen in animals. There's a lot of drug testing that happens in animals. And we keep continuing to test new drugs in animals, even though the NIH itself, the National Institutes of Health, has found that a whopping 95% of new drugs that looked safe and effective in animals goes on to fail when it gets to human clinical trials. And even the former director of the NIH has admitted that testing on animals doesn't work, and we need to start doing something that's more relevant for humans. So, you know, the NIH keeps dumping more than $20 billion every year into these experiments involving animals, but there's clear alternatives. We need to just ditch these outdated animal tests and switch to the modern and animal-free research methods that are really better and our best route to finding cures and treatments for humans that we desperately need. So there's alternatives like computer modeling, in vitro methods, organs on chips, 3D human tissue printing. There's really a lot already being developed, and they would be, you know, we could have a lot more if that $20 billion being wasted torturing and killing these animals was going into alternative research methods instead.
Yeah. Okay. So what is PETA's plan to change the system, and how can listeners get involved or find out more?
Yeah. So PETA scientists have developed the Research Modernization Deal, or the RMD, and that outlines a strategy to phase out the use of animals in favor of these human-relevant research methods that will yield far better data. And when presented with the RMD, the European Union actually passed a resolution to phase out animal experimentation. And even just recently here in the U.S., the FDA Modernization Act, which made it so that we could end the outdated regulation that required animal tests before new drugs were approved, that was signed into law here. So there's been a lot of really good progress, but we're still needing more. So we're asking everyone who's interested to join us, and you can urge the NIH yourself to redirect these billions of taxpayer dollars that are being wasted on these ineffective animal experiments and put that money into human-relevant research methods instead that will actually advance human health. And so we've set up a way for listeners to make that really simple. You can just text the word WRONG to 73822. And that'll take you to a super quick process where you can ask your member of Congress to endorse the research modernization deal. So it's just WRONG to 73822.
Okay, awesome. And then PETA.org, they can find out more information about what's going on and what you're doing?
Absolutely, yes. PETA.org, you can see all the different videos we've been able to receive through Public Information Act and learn more about the campaigns we have going on and what's happening inside laboratories.
Okay, perfect. So PETA.org is the website. PETA.org stands for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA.org. And if you want to get involved and send a message to your member of Congress, you can just text WRONG to 73822. So text the word WRONG to 73822. And again, the website is PETA.org. And Amy, I want to thank you so much for being here and shedding some light on what's happening that I'm sure the listeners didn't know about and that our taxpayer dollars are going to help fund and how people can make a difference in this. So I really appreciate your time and sharing with us. Thanks, Amy.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
A tree can be a warrior, battling global challenges with greater courage. A tree can be a solution, cleaning our air, supporting our communities, and protecting our wildlife. A tree can be noble, growing hope in every corner of the world. That's why now is the time for trees. Millions of trees. Join our planting movement at arborday.org.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and I'm Heather Vail. I'm speaking with Dr. Griffin Cole, past president of the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Dr. Cole is board certified in naturopathic medicine and earned a degree in integrative biological dental medicine, and he's here to discuss the great fluoride debate. Dr. Cole, thank you so much for being here today.
Pleasure to be here, Heather.
So when did fluoride start getting put in public water supplies?
1945 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That was the first city to ever add fluoride to their water supply.
Okay. And there's been a debate over the practice ever since, and some would even call it a conspiracy theory. What do we know at this point?
Well, we know at this point what we've known, honestly, probably since day one, which is that the intended purpose of it trying to decrease cavities has not proven to actually play out that way. So if you look at the science of this, and I know most dentists, you know, we sort of take things at face value, and we've been told since dental school that adding it to our water supply helps fight decay, but the science does not back that up. And the latest studies now that are coming out about lower IQ in babies born to women who ingest fluoridated water during pregnancy are very damning.
So you said we knew this since day one. So if that was the case, why did they continue doing it all these years? I mean, that maybe I'm bringing up the conspiracy theory now, but why would we continue to do it?
You know, I truly don't know the answer to that. I can just tell you that, you know, there was a couple of dentists who had seen patients in their city, which had naturally fluoride levels that were very high, had less cavities. And so I think that organized dentistry thought, well, wow, if that's the case, then maybe if we add this to all the water supplies, then all the children will have less cavities. And that's just not true.
Got it. Okay. So you mentioned now that we're finding it potentially reduces IQ in kids. How exactly does fluoride do that to babies?
Well, so the National Toxicology Program, which is a part of Health and Human Services, our government, looks at, you know, they review studies from all over the world to see, is there a problem? Is there a substance that's hazardous to our environment and humans? And so they reviewed 52 worldwide studies on fluoride in the water and definitely found brain impairments in babies born to women who ingested fluoridated water. So lower IQ up to as much as 7 points in at levels that are lower than what's in all the water supplies right now.
Okay, so we know that this can happen in the womb when the woman is pregnant. Does it also affect IQ as children grow up and as we in adults drink fluoridated water?
So great question. I wouldn't say as adults, but they definitely showed that babies who were fed formula using fluoridated water also had some brain dysfunction.
Okay. So can good oral health be maintained with healthier alternatives to fluoride instead?
For sure. I mean, I if we stick to some sound principles that we all learned, a good sound diet, right? One that's low in sugar, high in vegetables, good fats, ample protein, and obviously good home care, brushing, flossing, tongue cleaning. You can gargle with warm salt water and get a great antibacterial effect that way. So really just things that we know, but maybe we don't focus on enough, that is enough. Good, clean, nutrient-dense foods is enough to fight most oral problems.
Okay, so could we choose fluoride-free toothpaste, for example, or some people use charcoal or baking soda to brush their teeth and then say no to fluoride treatments at the dentist? Like, should we be limiting fluoride as much as possible?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we get it, what, like it's in bottled drinks, it's in some dietary supplements, a lot of prescription medications, toothpaste, as you mentioned, mouth rinses. We just have so many sources of it that you really can't avoid it altogether. But I would definitely recommend a fluoride-free toothpaste and not getting the varnish placed on your teeth like they offer at some offices. It's just too much.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what is biological dentistry?
Yeah. So it's sort of a self-named specialty, if you will. We biologic dentists, we practice like functional medicine doctors in that we look at the whole person. Right. So instead of just kind of drilling and filling and doing normal procedures, we want to know what's the underlying cause of their symptoms. So if somebody's getting a lot of cavities, why is that happening? And then, of course, we fix the teeth just like regular dentists. But we're very concerned with the underlying causes. One, two, we don't work with materials that we know are toxic to the human body, like mercury, nickel, and fluoride. So we're very cautious about that as well.
Okay, so it sounds more like a holistic or a naturopathic approach.
For sure, for sure. But again, you know, we still do all the same dental procedures. We just want to get to the, you know, why is this happening? And then once we fix things, then hopefully they stay fixed and those problems don't reoccur.
And you don't use fluoride at the office?
I never did. You know, again, you could argue, does fluoride have any effect at all that's beneficial? Topically applied to the teeth, it does have a beneficial antibacterial effect. But drinking in the water, you know, that's systemic and that's unnecessary. And we know it leads to a lot of problems. So that's the main focus, is that we need to get it out of the water supply.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a big can of worms, because as we mentioned at the beginning, it's, you know, it's pretty prevalent in water supplies across the country. Do you know, do you have the data, how many water supplies is it in or not in the U.S.?
Yeah, I do. It's about 73% of the water supplies throughout the U.S. are fluoridated. Now, please keep in mind that most of the rest of the world doesn't fluoridate. I mean, 98% of Europe doesn't. There's plenty of countries that don't do it at all. The U.S., New Zealand, and Australia, I think, are the ones that predominantly fluoridate. So it's not like this is a worldwide thing.
Yeah. Now, you said the solution is to get it out of the water systems, but that's a lot of fluoride that we're dealing with. So how can the listeners make a difference? What sorts of things could we do to help move that initiative forward?
Well, it's always grassroots. I mean, as I practiced in Austin, Texas for almost 30 years, and you would see me at the city council meetings talking about the science, about why we shouldn't fluoridate. Got a lot of groups going. I mean, people just need to be very active and vocal. And it starts at the small level, right? At the city level. And then once that starts happening, then you start to get referendums and votes. And that's really the only way to do it. Because unfortunately, like you said, this is a big deal in this country. And this bandwagon has been rolling for a long time. And it's not slowing down much. And I, as an anti-fluoridationist, am hopeful that this NTP report that came out is enough to turn the tide and to get people, even people that never even realize what fluoride can do to the organs in their body, to at least start questioning it. That's the start.
Yeah. So start from the city level, petition City Hall, attend City Hall meetings. Would it be any help at this point to call members of Congress?
Absolutely. Local, your state congressman and your federal congressman, for sure. Oftentimes, you just need to get a little nudge that this is still a concern for people.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so where could listeners go to get more information about this issue or even access the report data that you were referring to?
So there's a website. It's iaomt.org, iaomt.org. And you can find dentists who practice like I do. There is a library of information on oral medicine and care, and all this information as well that we're talking about.
Okay, awesome. So iaomt.org is the website to go to. It stands for International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. So iaomt.org, and you can find out lots of information there. You can find out about biological dentists and look at the data about fluoridated water across the country. And Dr. Cole, I want to thank you so much for being here and finally talking about this, because I think it's one of those topics that a lot of people question, but there's nobody out there actually questioning it as well who has the authority and the expertise to do so. So I'm really glad that you're here talking about this, letting people know, and also giving us ways that we can make a difference and hopefully make a change for the future. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. I appreciate it.
Staying active and healthy as we age starts with strong bones. To keep your bones strong, you need calcium, vitamin D, and regular exercise. A bone density test called DEXA helps detect low bone mass and bone disease called osteoporosis. If you're 65 or older, Medicare provides free bone density tests every 2 years. Ask your doctor to schedule yours. For more information on how to be bone strong, visit pathtogoodbonehealth.org.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, or VA, is encouraging veterans to take care of their mental health through the Today I Am campaign. Find out more or access resources and support at maketheconnection.net. That's maketheconnection.net. Also for Mental Health Awareness Month, the Titan Brands Hospitality Group is donating 15% of all Drink of the Month and dessert proceeds to the Alternative Peer Group to help local teens with addiction issues. That's at both Husong's locations, Boca Park or Mandalay Place, and A Slice of Vegas, also at Mandalay Place. Find out more about the Alternative Peer Group or make a donation at apglv.org. That's apglv.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, June 5th at 8 p.m. benefiting the National Association of Women in Construction, and Monday, June 19th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Nevada Wheelchair Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. AARP is holding its first Benefits Badass contest, and you could win $50,000 for submitting a 2-minute video telling how you make use of your AARP benefits, and you don't have to be over 50 to join. Upload your video by this Monday, May 29th at aarpbenefitsbadass.org. That's aarpbenefitsbadass.org. Three Square's Bag Childhood Hunger campaign is doubling its impact for a few more days thanks to matching sponsors. That goes through May 31st. Now, for every dollar donated, Three Square can provide up to 6 wholesome, nutritious meals to Southern Nevada children and families in need. Find out more or make a donation at threesquare.org. That's threesquare.org. The LGBTQ Center of Southern Nevada's free Enchanted Forest Youth Prom is happening next Saturday, June 3rd from 7 to 10 p.m. at Chaos Nightclub inside Palms Casino Resort. Celebrate the beauty of diversity and inclusivity as you make lifelong memories. All young people aged 13 to 18, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity, are welcome to attend. Register for free or find out more at thecenterlv.org under news. That's thecenterlv.org and look under news. Communities and Schools of Nevada is holding its annual graduation campaign through mid-June to support graduating high school seniors. Donations of any amount will help ensure Nevada students have the resources they need to graduate successfully. You can donate or find out more at cisnevada.org/graduate. That's cisnevada.org/graduate. And Chef Pete Gioni's running his Cooking for a Cure fundraising campaign with a goal of raising $100,000 over 10 weeks to support the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. You can donate at the various partner restaurants or directly through his website until June 10th. Find out more, learn about healthy eating for cancer patients, see the list of participating restaurants, or make a donation at cookingforacure.com. That's cookingforacure.com.